Congress is using the review process to kind of just block and override the will of the people, which is not what our democracy is founded on.
We, the people of DC, run DC. If we want everything to shut down in the capital of this country, it can, and they're welcome to test us.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to A More Perfect District, a podcast from the ACLU of DC. We work to protect and advance civil liberties and civil rights for people who live in, work in, and visit DC, in court, in the legislature, and in the street. I'm your host for this episode, Alicia Yass, Policy Advocacy Director at the ACLU of DC. Each episode, we take a deep dive into a civil rights and civil liberty issue facing Washington, DC today, and explore how we can protect our rights and move closer to a more just and free DC. DC is a city of nearly 700,000 people. We pay federal taxes, we serve in the military, we elect a mayor and a council, and yet Congress has the power to override our laws, block our budget, and make decisions about our district without a single vote from the people who actually live here. That is not democracy. At the heart of this is the relationship between Congress and DC from the DC Home Rule Act. And understanding that relationship is essential to understanding how DC residents can protect our rights, our communities, and our own self-determination. Today, we're going to dig in and explore this a bit. First, I'll be joined by my colleague, Melissa Wasser, Senior Policy Counsel at the ACLU of DC. We'll break down how Congress and DC are connected through the DC Home Rule Act and what the fight to protect DC's local affairs really looks like. Then I'll be joined by Kia Chatterjee from Free DC, a local organization led by DC residents who are organizing to defend our communities and claim the right to self-determination. They'll share what this fight looks like on the ground and how everyday residents can get involved. Because at the end of the day, this isn't just about politics or policy. It's about whether the people of DC have the power to shape our own lives and our own communities. Hey, Melissa, thanks so much for being here today.
Awesome. Thanks, Alicia, for having me.
Yeah. So before we get into it, tell me just a little bit about your role at the ACLU DC, what you do and your background.
Yeah. So I'm a senior policy counsel here at the ACLU of DC and have been here for about 4 years. So I work on issues that deal with DC home rule, criminal justice reform, and reproductive justice. And so I work with the council and Congress to kind of advocate on our issues, do some legislative analysis and research, and really push for our issues at both of those levels. And then my background, I'm originally from Northeast Ohio, and I moved out to DC after I graduated from law school and got my master's in 2017. I spent my second summer of law school working in DC. And I fell in love with the district. I loved being here. It was my first time being outside of Ohio and realized this is where I needed to be and knew I wanted to do work that could take both of those degrees and kind of translate for folks, you know, all of these complex topics into something that was a little more accessible. And so I've been at several nonprofits that have done different work like whistleblower reform, government accountability, and have been in the district ever since.
Great. Well, we are so appreciative of the work that you do with us, for us. And I know I love working with you on these issues. So today we're going to be talking about some of that work that we do on DC home rule and our push for eventual statehood. So I guess DC and home rule has been in the news a lot recently. It's really sort of come to the forefront for a lot of people. And I think that means a lot of people who maybe weren't paying attention to it or didn't know about DC home rule before are asking questions now. So for people who are just getting used to this idea of home rule, what are some of the basics that might help them understand what DC home rule is?
Sure. So DC home rule refers to the DC Home Rule Act of 1973. It was a bill that gave DC residents the ability to elect a mayor and their DC council and advisory neighborhood commissioners to kind of deal with the day-to-day affairs of the district. DC Home Rule Act also gave Congress a way to disapprove of laws and to review our laws before they take effect. In DC, it's a little different. When they pass a law in DC, all of our bills have to go through Congress and they have to review all legislation that's passed before our council, before it becomes law. And that includes things like our public safety laws, local traffic laws, and even our budgets. And so that's just one of the ways that they can kind of meddle and interfere in what we're trying to do here in DC.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of things that you said that I think are worth some emphasis. First, sure. Home rule is only 1973.
Yes.
That's just over 50 years ago.
Right.
So this is not a system that has been in place forever.
Right.
What sort of existed before home rule?
Sure. So like you said, it's still relatively new, even though it's, you know, been over 50 years. I think if we want to look even before, you think back to like the Civil War, and you look at the makeup of DC, you know, DC is Chocolate City, and we've always had a majority like Black and Brown voters here in the city. And I think after the Civil War, Black voters were really trying to exercise their political power. And just as that was happening, Congress stepped in and said, we don't like this. And they replaced DC's locally formed government with these like federal commissioners that would run the district. And so, you know, they wanted to make sure that this region that was, again, heavily, you know, Black and Brown folks, you know, did not have their full voting rights. They did not have control of their government. If you look right before home rule, you know, before the 70s too, they had those federally appointed commissioners, but then also members of Congress were responsible for the district. And so, again, when people think about their members of Congress and what they send them to Congress for, it's not to figure out when DC's trash can get picked up or when schools can, you know, send their kids, you set a school calendar, right? So they had to deal with national issues and then also local issues. So congressional offices got calls about potholes in the street. They got calls about crime. And that's in addition to all the calls they get from their own constituents. And I think when the 70s rolled around and there was a big push for this home rule government, I think a lot of, and the history does show that congressional members were really eager to give this up because they had too much going on in their home states to actually handle both of those jobs.
And yet now we're sort of seeing Congress want to take more of that control. Right. We've seen in the past couple of years more disapproval resolutions than in the prior history of home rule. Is there more about that you can tell us?
Sure. So for the disapproval resolutions, particularly, like you said, once the DC Council passes a bill and it has to go through congressional review, that process is it's either 30 working days, which is a lot longer than, you know, normally 30 calendar days, or 60 working days if it's a criminal bill, Congress has to review legislation. Normally, that's pretty passive. If we look at the past, you know, 50 years, there have been quite a handful of disapproval resolutions that not only have come up, but even a smaller amount that have actually been successful. And so we've seen in the last two Congresses alone, a historic uptick in how many disapproval resolutions are coming forward from members of Congress to basically, if they are passed, nullify that local law that has been passed. And so I think that really, you know, DC residents should really be concerned about this, right? Because, you know, they're electing people at council. They're electing a mayor. We just recently had a primary election. We'll have an election, a general election this fall. And they want to elect people that represent them and their values. And that means that those leaders pass laws that represent their values. And Congress is using the review process to kind of just block and override the will of the people, which is not what our democracy is founded on.
Yeah. And it's also, there's like the double-edged sword of this. It's like, we're electing our council and our mayor to do what the people of DC want them to do.
Right.
But then there's the flip of that. If they aren't doing what we want them to do, we can not vote for them again. We have that power to not put them in office again. And yet when these members of Congress are meddling in our laws, we've got no way to hold them accountable. We can't keep them from doing the same thing in the next Congress because we have no votes for them.
Right. That's exactly right. So there's no accountability that DC residents have towards those members of Congress that continue to meddle in DC affairs. And so I think, you know, what I want people to know across the country, right, is that if you're a voter, again, you're voting to elect your member of Congress to represent you and issues that are happening in your state, in your district. You know, members of Congress aren't elected because they want to figure out, hey, I want to know if a DC driver can turn right on red or whether they can use automated traffic cameras in the district, right? They're sent to Congress to deal with issues of national importance. And through reading over 75 bills that have been introduced that impact DC in some way, you know, Congress is choosing to micromanage DC through those bills. And we're seeing that they've introduced four times as many bills this session to micromanage DC as they have to combat issues of inflation.
And people probably care a lot more about that people across the country.
Right. People care about the rising cost of their groceries, right? They care about how much their rent costs or, you know, if they could even like buy a home. We found that like 3 times as many bills to micromanage DC as there are to make bills to make home ownership more accessible for people. That's not what people elect their members of Congress for. They don't want them to go and waste taxpayer money. And it's really just inefficient for what Congress is supposed to be doing. We already, the voters of DC elect our leaders and they should be the ones representing us. And Congress shouldn't be interfering with that process through this.
Sure. And I mean, talking about money, I think one of the issues of home rule that sort of drew a lot of people's attention to this in the first instance was in 2025, Congress blocked DC from spending its own money.
Yes. So, and that's very like, just to hit that home, it was $1 billion of local money. You know, when we think of ways that, and having worked on issues of, and worked on both sides of the aisle in previous, you know, in this job and in previous roles as well, like wasting taxpayer money is something that I think everyone can get behind as an issue that like, they don't want their tax dollars wasted. And I think that was a big talking point that we heard from Congress when the $1 billion you're referring to was, oh, we're going to save this money. This is going to save taxpayer money. This was already money that DC had. And basically it's like, we took this $1 billion, we put it in a lockbox and we couldn't touch it. And again, if we were a state, this would have already been rectified. We would have been able to spend that money. There wouldn't have been this oversight that led to preventing us from using our own money.
Right. And that has real implications for people because right. that the city, the government, the had to then figure out how to accommodate that $1 billion that was missing by not hiring for roles that were vacant that they were planning to hire for, or doing more serious things and actually cutting programming that was in existence. And that's harming actual people's lives.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah.
So when we're looking at this, like, what are we doing at the ACLU DC to try to address this issue?
Sure. So a couple things, right? We're educating the public. We have a lot of resources on our website about, you know, what is home rule? Why is it important? Why should people care about it? You know, these are home rule and, you know, DC statehood in particular have a lot of crossover with a lot of different issues that people care about. Voting rights, you know, taxes, local, you know, local autonomy and control. And so, you know, we're educating the public about what home rule is, like having this conversation here today, and letting them know to contact their members of Congress since, you know, people in DC can't. Another like core part of my job, which I think is really cool, is getting to talk to members of Congress and their staff about how they can not just support bills like H.R. 51 and S-51, which is the Washington, D.C. Admission Act, which would give D.C. statehood, which is great, but also being a sponsor of that bill, which we see a lot of members of Congress are, that's not the only thing they can do to support D.C. In order to protect D.C., they have to protect home rule, and they can do that with not voting on bills that would negatively impact DC and meeting with them and having real conversations about, you know, what are you hearing from your constituents? Is this an actual issue that someone in, you know, state X, Y, or Z is calling you about to say, we care about DC traffic, DC public safety? And then just reminding them and kind of, you know, tying together their previous support for bills in the past to what it takes to protect DC, because we think, you know, protecting DC home rule means at the end of the day, protecting democracy.
Great. But what we're doing is not enough, right?
Right.
We need more than that.
Right.
So what can people do, both those who live in DC and those who live in the rest of the country?
Right. So, so knowing the facts about home rule, like we've talked about today, is crucial. You know, again, I think the ultimate goal that we're fighting for is DC statehood. And, you know, for people who want to learn more about DC statehood, they can go to dcstatehoodnow.org. There's an entire website. And like I mentioned, all of the issues that you care about will likely be on there and have some connection to statehood in some way. I think if you are in DC, because you don't have a voting member of Congress, you likely have at least a family or a friend that does not live in DC. And so you can spread the word to your friends and family and tell them, hey, on our behalf, we need you to contact your members of Congress and ask them to support these bills, ask them to protect DC home rule by making sure they're not voting on these anti-DC bills when they come to the floor or come up in committee. I think that's really important. And then for people outside of DC, you know, I think, again, they need to contact their members of Congress. And we've also made it super easy to do that on our website. People can go to acludc.org and they can sign an action alert to tell members of Congress to stop micromanaging our nation's capital and to make sure that we can push for DC statehood. And again, we cannot achieve DC statehood alone. I want to be 100% clear. We cannot do this by ourselves. I wish we could. I really wish that we could, but we can't. And so it's going to take an effort by all of us to spread the word, educate folks, and then give them the resources and the tools that they need to keep pushing the members of Congress until we can not just get a DC statehood bill to pass the House like it did in 2021, but to pass the House and the Senate and to eventually become law. Yeah. So we can become the 51st state.
So another thing a lot of people here in D.C. have noticed and has made some national news is National Guard on the streets in D.C. How does that play into home rule and how is that impacted by the authority D.C. has to manage its own affairs?
Yeah, so we have seen an uptick in National Guard, I think, since last August when the president said that he was going to bring in the National Guard to kind of handle all of the problems that were happening in D.C. because he wanted to make D.C. safe and beautiful. D.C. was already safe and beautiful, but I digress. You know, we've seen an uptick in National Guard across the city. You know, it's a little jarring. Like I said, I've been here almost 9 years now, and it's jarring, honestly, to go to a metro station and see National Guard troops standing in the stations. You know, I talk to my friends in the city who are parents and they have to like wonder if, you know, they're going to walk by National Guard troops that are armed while they take their kids to summer camp. It's a very like dystopian thing that we have to kind of think about now. And you mentioned about how that plays into home rule, right? So I think we've seen across the country that, you know, both Congress and the president have tried things in D.C. and used D.C. really as a testing ground for what kind of power that they can grab before they test it out in other parts of the country. And I think the National Guard is one of them because we've seen now in cities like Chicago and Los Angeles, you know, the National Guard was sent in and the National Guard had to be removed because there wasn't a justification for it. The difference in those states, right? Those cities are in states that have governors. And governors are usually the head of the National Guard. They can call in the National Guard. They can send them home. Because DC is not a state, our equivalent would maybe be the mayor, and that the mayor would have control of the National Guard. But the mayor doesn't have control of the National Guard. The president controls the DC National Guard. And so the reason that those cities can remove their troops but we can't is because they're in states and they can control it. The president has said that he wants the National Guard here and they will be here. We've read reporting that says they'll be here till 2029. And that's just frankly a new reality that DC residents have to really deal with. And it's really intimidating too. If you look at other segments of the community, you know, what that does to our unhoused neighbors or folks who are undocumented, you know, we need to make sure that we're keeping an eye on what's happening in the streets because it's very clear that this president has no intention of removing the National Guard anytime soon. But if we were a state, we would be able to control whether those troops would be able to be in the district or not.
Yeah. And I think an important thing to know, a reporting came out recently. Research was done into crime and what has changed since the National Guard was deployed in August to now. And they found that crimes of opportunity, so like pickpocketing, things like that on the mall may have gone down, but the real crimes that people are concerned about were not affected by the National Guard presence.
Right.
So them being here is not even for, I mean, we always knew that the crime was going down in DC prior to these deployments. That was a fact we knew. And then the National Guard came here under this auspice of crime. And they're not even having that impact. And, you know, I don't know what message that sends to people here in the district that we have to live with a military presence on our streets every day.
Right. And I mean, even coming here today, you know, taking the metro to work and seeing, you know, metro troops in guard troops in the metro stations. Right. And seeing guard troops walking on the streets. I mean, we've seen it in local reporting, too, that these troops are walking on different sidewalks and corridors of the city that aren't even, you know, experiencing those increases in crime. They're just, it's a show of force.
Yeah.
And it's something that does not keep our city safer. It does not keep DC residents safer. And the people who know how to keep DC safe are our local leaders. And so again, if we were able to control the National Guard, if the mayor or a governor of the 51st state of DC could handle the National Guard and control them and tell them to leave, that would be one thing. But we are unique that the president controls our National Guard, and it seems like they're here to stay.
Yeah. And it's not just the DC National Guard, actually.
Several
states have also sent their National Guard at the behest of the president, because any governor can ask other states to send their National Guard to assist. And that's essentially what's been done here, just not at the will of the people of DC or the elected leadership of DC.
Yeah. And what I want also people to realize is this isn't like a couple National Guard troops here and there from a couple states. I mean, it's over 3,000 National Guard troops that are here on our streets. And we're supposed to get more in advance of, you know, July 4th and the America 250 celebrations that'll happen on the National Mall. And for me, it's kind of hard to realize, oh, there are as many National Guard troops here in DC as there are people in my hometown.
Wow.
In Ohio. And I try to think about that, like that. And I know DC is a bigger place and I understand, you know, but it's still something that kind of just, it doesn't sit right with me, and it doesn't sit right with a lot of people that this is like their new reality. That's a lot of people who, you know, again, when you sign up to be in the National Guard, you think you're going to help your local community where you sign up in your states, and they're coming here and they're standing on street corners and they're on their phones and they're not doing anything to keep us safer. It's just a show of force. And again, it's a test. It's a testing ground to see where else can we try this. How much more can we get away with, before someone challenges us? And again, like, we have to make sure that we are protecting DC and making sure that, again, at the end of the day, when we protect DC, we protect democracy. And so making sure that they're, you know, getting out with, you know, at the end of this deployment, I mean, is going to be, you know, a big factor for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I think people in DC should not have to live their daily lives walking to the grocery store, walking to work, whatever it might be, and see military troops. Like, that's just not the American ideal that so many people get to live across the country. And here in DC, we're being forced to live in this state of anxiety and fear for no reason.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what we deserve.
And I think, like, people need to be aware they can have an impact even in the interim before that.
Right.
So yes, statehood is the goal, but there's a lot that can be done in between. And if a disapproval resolution about DC is up for a vote, or if a bill that's, you know, on turning right on red is coming up, people can also contact their members of Congress about those. I think we all know members of Congress are going to listen to their constituents more than they're going to listen to me or you. And so having people reaching out and being that defense of DC, it's just so important.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the disapproval resolutions. And I just want to also mention, you know, there are also riders that pop up on bills, not only in like the appropriations process, where members of Congress usually add other pieces of legislation that really aren't connected to what they're actually talking about in that piece of legislation. But also, you know, we're getting to the end of a congressional period. We're going to have a new Congress soon. And so we're going to see a lot of, you know, bills come back and a lot of things move forward. And we need everybody, you know, to stay vigilant when those things do pop up, whether it's a rider, whether it's a disapproval resolution or a standalone piece of legislation moves forward. We need everyone to, you know, kind of mobilize. And I think also a good way to do that, in addition to the action alert, we have an email list on our website. We will tell you when you need to contact your member of Congress. And so it would be great. Again, ACLUDC.org would be a great way for people to connect. It's right on the front of the website.
Perfect. And I think, we're doing a lot of work on this, and we are just looking for more people to join us and uplift the message that we are putting out there. And it's really the democratic principles that our country is founded on. I think that's what we're fighting for.
Yeah. Well, again, when we protect DC, we protect democracy. Yeah. So it takes all of us.
There you go. That's great. Well, stepping away from the serious for a minute, you're fighting for DC for a reason. You said, you know, you love the area. What's your favorite thing about DC?
Oh, geez. So I love having public transit. Coming from a state where I had to have a car for everything, moving from having a car, having to park and figure it out, to getting on the metro to come to work, to go to a baseball game, go to a hockey game at, you know, Capital One. It's been really great to get around there. Also, the food scene. I mean, there's so many good restaurants and so many good places to be. Rumi's Kitchen in Mount Vernon is like my favorite. It's a Iranian restaurant and it's very delicious. Some of the best food I've had while I've been in DC. And so those are two like main things that I love about DC and the community. I mean, the culture and the community that we've been able to build here in the past 9 years that I've been here has been really great.
Yeah. And I mean, that those feed into each other. Like you find the restaurants because you can get there because of the public transportation.
Right.
So that's great. Well, glad to hear it. And thanks for sharing a recommendation.
Yeah, absolutely.
For folks to try.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being here today, for this conversation, and for educating us on these issues.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Hi, Kaya. Thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you're here today to talk about your work with FreeDC. So let's start with the basics. What does FreeDC do and how did you get involved?
Yeah, so I am one of the four co-founders of FreeDC. And we decided to start FreeDC, and I should say really relaunch FreeDC, because it's a movement that's been around for a very, very long time, you know, starting with Marion Barry during the civil rights era. And we relaunched in January of 2025 because we were hearing these really specific threats to DC being made on the campaign trail by Trump. He was saying he was going to take over DC. And we decided that we needed to take that seriously and we needed to organize our communities and our people in order to make sure that we were using the best information, the best social science, the best training materials we had to be totally ready so that we could make sure that their attacks on us would actually backfire on them and only grow our strength as the people of DC.
Are there any examples of maybe activations that FreeDC has done that people might be aware of?
Sure. So like anytime our home rule is under attack, so you obviously know, Alicia, but you know, the home rule
passed
in 1973, enacted in 1974, the result of huge amount of push during the civil rights era, but we didn't get statehood, which is what we really wanted during that time. And so every single time they have attacked our home rule, we have responded. And so, you know, and really every time they've attacked our people, we've responded. And so, you know, it started out in the very early days of this regime. We had, you know, illegal firings of federal workers. We had, you know, Trump taking over the board of the Kennedy Center. And then we started to have these like very serious attacks from Congress at a really unprecedented clip. It's not that Congress had never done it before, it's that the pace at which they were doing it started to increase. So one of the first things that happened was that they froze $1.1 billion of our local funds. So we immediately said, this is not going to work for us. We need these funds. Everybody come down to the Senate. And they made a strategic error, which is that they actually did this during a DC public schools, a DCPS, day off. So, it was a day when lots of parents, me included, had kids at home. And we just said, like, bring your kids and come on down. And thousands of people came. It was pretty unprecedented. We were in all 100 Senate offices. We actually got a unanimous vote out of the Senate for the DC Local Funds Act. And even though technically we lost that, in that it never got introduced in the House, from our perspective, we actually really won that skirmish with them, because what happened was, A, we grew a lot. B, we were much more united across DC. You know, unions came down, faith leaders came down, so many organizations came down to fight this. And there were just so many of us that it actually gave our local government the courage to spend a huge chunk of that money anyway. So we were really able to reduce harm and shift loyalties. Again, we got a unanimous vote from the Senate on an issue regarding DC.
Yeah.
That was called the DC Local Funds Act. So those are a few examples.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been, I think, DC residents have learned a lot more about what the difference is between home rule and statehood, even in just the past few years, even though, as you said, home rule has been in effect for over 50 years. And so that power that Congress has because of the Home Rule Act and the sort of the joint oversight over DC, what impact does that have on DC residents and our communities?
Yeah, it really affects every aspect of life in DC. Very recently, Congress was attempting to defund a program called DC Tag, very recently. And that's a program that like lots of parents rely on. It's kids going to universities because we don't have like a large land grant university in DC. But really it's everyday life, the number of things that they come after, there's a long history of them coming after like marijuana, bodily autonomy, rights to abortion. But more recently, it's really just everything, it's like threatening to rip up a bike lane. It's like, mm-hmm. Traffic safety, it's cash bail. It's so many important criminal justice reforms. And it's just really about every aspect of our lives that they are getting involved in. And of course, this is a body where we have no representation. So there is no consent of the governed. The things they are doing are really against our wishes on a regular basis across every single issue. Whether your issue is, criminal justice or environment or bodily autonomy or education, or, I could go on and on. It doesn't matter what your issue is. Congress is doing things that are against the values and the wishes of the people of DC. And we don't consent to it.
Yeah. And I know a senator recently made a comment about they have to legislate for the people of DC and in the interests of DC, but they're not talking to the people of DC. What experience, I know Free DC has gone to many members of Congress's office, you mentioned with the kids. What type of interactions do you have when you go to these congressional offices?
Yeah, I mean, our volunteers are up on the Hill all the time. Because again, anytime they attack us, we respond. That's a core part of what we do. And, a lot of times you'll hear from them immediately, like, oh, we only have meetings for constituents. And we train our folks to say, like, look, until you have a Senate office you can point me to, I am your constituent. And often they try to turn us away, and part of what we are trying to do is really reveal the harm that is happening, but also redeem ourselves and just say, like, look, we're parents too. We're neighbors, we're brothers, we're sisters, we're aunts, mm-hmm. we're human beings. We deserve dignity the same way everyone else in this country has. There's no reason we shouldn't have equal rights under the law. Sometimes we have to argue on the merits of the bill itself, but in large part, what we're trying to explain to people is that this isn't really about cash bail, right? Or whatever it is. It's not about cash bail. The only reason you'd want to increase cash bail is if our people weren't showing up for court. Our people do show up for court.
At higher rates than the rest of the country.
Than anyone else. Like, it doesn't even make sense when you go on the merits of the bill. But part of what we try to help people understand is, like, look, this is all, it's coming from, this is a death by a thousand cuts. They're trying to destabilize DC. Why would they want to destabilize the capital of this country? Well, if you want to know what somebody will do the next time they're voted out of office, look at what they did the last time they were voted out of office. So we know that this is a regime that tried to prevent a transfer of power on January 6th. So what they're trying to do now is destabilize DC financially and in every way they can so that they can suppress dissent more easily so that they can prevent a transfer of power. Also, we know this stuff because they say it, right? Like, they literally sell merch You know, the Heritage Foundation is posting, you know, blogs about how they could just refuse to swear in Democrats. So we know what they're trying to do because they're telling us what they're trying to do. And so when members of Congress don't see that, they think like, oh, well, this is just about like high speed chases in D.C. But even if you just ignore that, you shouldn't do anything that destabilizes the capital of the country, because we know from examples all around the world that you have to have an outpouring of action. You have to have an outpouring of non-cooperation, of people pouring into the streets saying, we are not going to go along with this, in order to get a transfer of power in a situation like this that we are in, which is a situation where we have like a really robust implementation of the authoritarian playbook. They're doing everything that authoritarians do step by step. And in these conditions, we have to protect the Capitol. We have to protect dissent in the Capitol.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note here, it's rare for the residents of the Capitol to not be fully participating in the democracy. That is unusual that we have that.
Yeah, I don't know of literally any other example in the world. It is a fundamental flaw in our democracy and a weakness in our democracy. Because again, if you want to have transfers of power regularly, you have to protect dissent in the Capitol. You can't put that right to dissent in the hands of the people who would want to suppress it, right? Yeah. Like, it's just a very fundamental flaw that I don't, you know, like, and, you know, again, you know this, Alicia, but like, when it was written into the Constitution that there should be like, you know, a federal enclave, it does not say that it must include our public schools and our neighborhoods and our farmers markets. That is not, it does not say this, that the federal enclave must include every farmers market in DC, or every public school in DC, or every, you know, recreation center in DC. No, it just says there has to be one. So there should be one. It can include the White House and it can include the Capitol. They can even have the Smithsonian. But what they should not have for the sake of our democracy is our homes and our communities.
Yeah, so where people live and have their lives and their families and their friends and all of that.
And where there are people who need to have the right to dissent.
Yeah. And I think what also, to put this all in perspective, prior to Home Rule, prior to when that act passed, Congress was much more involved in the day-to-day affairs of DC, and they didn't like it. That was one of the reasons Home Rule happened. They didn't want to be managing our public schools. They didn't want to be managing our trash collection and all of those day-to-day things. And yet now we're seeing Congress almost move back to that micromanaging of those day-to-day affairs that are really supposed to be on the local level, only really affect the local community. And yet they're trying to seal it back to destabilize, to have power, to exert control, whatever it might be. But we know it doesn't work. It's happened. Yeah. So,
and I think it's important to say it was very racialized why they took that control to begin with, right? So if you go back to 1874, then we're looking at, oh, well, Black people had a vote. Black people were in DC Council, and then they took that away. This too is a very racialized decision that is happening, right? Like, the fact that we have unequal representation is a direct line from like slavery to today.
Yeah.
And the actions of today, as we've seen in this administration, are driven by, you know, their hatred for diversity and equity and inclusion and immigrants and all these things that really, like, DC values mean that we love those things. In fact, like, we love diversity, we love equity, we love inclusion, we love immigrants. Like,
yeah,
those are our values in DC. And when they attack us on those things, again, it just comes down to like the basics of this country. Like, you know, if you, you know, like, for, you know, my personal view, right, is that like, this is stolen land that we are on. But even if you take the view that like there was a right to be here and you're like really steeped in the Declaration of Independence, well, then you should really care about consent of the governed, right? You should really care about, you know, taxation without representation.
And
you
limited
really
federal government.
About, yeah, exactly. So these are all things that through their own line of logic, they should care about, but the white supremacy of this regime has meant that they ignore all of that in favor of oppression of the people of DC.
Yeah. And a lot of the work of Free DC, as you mentioned, is getting people up and advocating in front of Congress, probably people who've never done that before, which can be scary. I mean, it's something, anytime you do something new, it's scary. But Congress can be intimidating. It's big, fancy buildings and, you know, all of that. So what's the first step for people who want to get involved? How do they get involved with Free DC?
So the first step for everybody coming on board, whether that's because they want to do neighborhood, you know, work or Congress work, is to come through an orientation. So people can go to freedcproject.org. We have orientations twice a month. And that's where we really just share the basic, like we have like a three-step plan for coming out from under authoritarianism. It is that we build our base locally, ward by ward, neighborhood by neighborhood in DC. Step one. Step two, we respond every time they attack us in strategic ways. So sometimes that's Congress attacking us. Sometimes it's the, you know, with a military occupation, it's literally the U.S. military. They're, you know, see, these are not small institutions they're sending after us, the Congress, the military. And so we have to be really strategic during those cycles of attack. And we have to respond, like, right? Like we have to make sure it backfires on them anytime they come after us. We want it to be like, oh, wow, we did attack them, but they grew bigger and more united and stronger. And then the third step of our plan is essentially to be ready for when conditions are ripe for mass collective non-cooperation, because ultimately we know that it is withdrawing our work, whether it's our work or it's our willingness to go along with what a prosecutor is saying in a court of law and be non-cooperative as jurors, whether it is, you know, as taxpayers, as is so anchored in the history of this country, whether it is, you know, whatever role it is as consumers, you know, we have to be ready for a moment when everybody is ready to say enough is enough. We are actually going to withhold our power because we know that actually we, the people of DC, run DC. If we want everything to shut down in the capital of this country, it can, and they're welcome to test us. But I think that it's really important for us to be ready for that step three of getting ourselves practiced in non-cooperation. So the orientation goes through some of that. It plugs people in, like, how can you get trained to do the specific thing you want to do? We have so many trainings to get people ready to do so many things, because the reality of living in DC right now is that we have 2,700 troops here from 15 states. We have a federal surge. We have regionally had 20,000 immigration-related arrests, plus 10,000 additional arrests from the federal surge forces. So the reality is that everybody does need to get trained up, because whether you want to get involved or don't want to get involved, a lot of people, like when I ask in a room full of people, how many people have actually seen like a gang of thugs, of federal agents trying to kidnap a neighbor, about a third of the people of DC raise their hands. And so whether or not you want to get involved, you may end up involved. And the more trained you are, the better off we all are. And so we're just trying to bring people's, like, honestly, skills up and understanding of the context up.
Yeah. And you may have just answered my next question, but I will give you an opportunity to answer this. If somebody has never heard of Free DC, doesn't even really know about these issues and is listening to us right now, what's like the one takeaway you want them to have from this conversation?
Plug in, be a joiner. You know, like, I know sometimes it feels like I already know everything, I got this. But we just have so much more power together than on our own. And so getting plugged in is so important. And, you know, whether it's with Free DC or not, honestly, it's really being anchored in a political home and an organization and a place where you are plugged into your own community and your own neighbors in a way where that makes your community ready to protect itself and ourselves. You know, like, my background is also like as a neighborhood commissioner, among other things. And so, like, I really do believe that we have such beautiful and tight-knit neighbors and neighborhoods in DC. Like, every neighborhood just has such such a unique sort of like culture to it and vibe to it that, you know, when we organize at that level, we are so much more powerful. And honestly, part of the way we got into this situation nationally, like the reason that we got here in part was not knowing our neighbors, right? And that allowed, you know, what fascists like to do is divide and turn groups against each other. And mm-hmm. not knowing our neighbors made that easy for them, right? It made it easy to demonize subgroups, yeah. whether that was trans neighbors or immigrant neighbors or anyone else. We created conditions where they were able to demonize us to each other. And to uncreate those conditions, we have to get plugged into organizations and we have to start to know our neighbors. And that's kind of the infrastructure we provide at Free DC. You can plug in and have a way to know the people who live around you and start getting active with them.
Yeah. And I think that you mentioned it before. That's a really great asset of DC. We have people from not only all over this country, but all over the world who've come to DC. It's yeah. such like the, to use the, you yeah. know, trite phrase, a melting pot. It really is. And I think we all benefit from that. And it makes our lives so much richer. So I know that's a great part about living here, but I want to ask you, like, aside from your Free DC work, what is something else that you really love about DC and that makes you call this place home?
Yeah, I mean, I love that it's so walkable and that you can take the bus or the metro anywhere. I just love that, you know, it is a place that has such an interesting history and culture, you know, like, you know, whether it's like go-go music or jazz music.
Yeah.
You know, like it's just, there's so much like cultural history in DC. And I think actually like, you know, people, I feel like New Yorkers are snobs about it, but I feel like we have good food in DC.
We do.
I mean, like, I just love like our small business scene, I think, is really quite beautiful. You know, bookstores, restaurants, etc. I just think it's a wonderful sense of community. And like I was saying before, I just love how every neighborhood has its own sort of like subculture and look and feel to it that is, you know, across the board feels pretty welcoming wherever you are.
Yeah. I mean, just think about all the like colorful row houses, just that in of itself is like cheery and welcoming. So yeah, love that too. Well, thank you so much for being here today. And thank you for the partnership between Free DC and ACLU DC. I think we do a lot of great things together. So excited for more of those to happen. So if everyone wants to get plugged in with both of our groups, we're constantly working together and can always use the support. So thank you.
Amazing. Thanks, Alicia.
Yeah. Have a great one.
You too.
That's it for this episode of A More Perfect District, a podcast from the ACLU of DC. I'm Amber Taylor, Strategic Communications Director. Thanks for spending time with us. Join us next time as we break down the civil rights and civil liberties issues impacting Washington, D.C. For show notes and ways to take action right now, visit acludc.org/podcast. And don't forget to follow, rate, and share this podcast to help more people stay informed. Till next time.